Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Later in the program, we're going to hear how the San Antonio Food Bank is fighting hunger this holiday season and how you can help. And in the second half, we're joined by District 9 Councilmember John Courage to talk about his gun buyback program and more. But let's begin with an investigation into how many unnatural deaths in Texas are initially investigated and ruled on by the county's Justice of the Peace. KXAN-TV in Austin is exposing this problem in Texas that's way overdue for a modern-day fix. We're joined by Josh Hinkle. He is the KXAN-NBC Austin Director of Investigations and Innovation. And Josh, welcome back to The Source.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Tell me overall, what are y'all investigating?
Well, essentially, we're investigating deaths in Texas. You know, Texas is a big state, and so there are a lot of different people that are investigating when unattended deaths happen throughout the state. Most counties do not have a medical examiner, which might be surprising to some people. So that's left to the responsibility of a justice of the peace, which is an elected position that is responsible for a lot of different judicial duties, including death inquests in those counties without medical examiners. These justices of the peace, again, are elected, so there is the question about politics sometimes, and they don't have the same degree of medical training that a medical examiner does, too. So some people believe that they should start thinking about ways to modernize the system here in Texas, which has this unique system compared to any other state.
In my reporting, I've run into problems with how JPs will rule on these unattended deaths or unnatural deaths in the state. That's one reason why our numbers of overdose deaths are kind of soft, and other kind of deaths are kind of unreliable at times across the state, because sometimes the local JP, he is vulnerable to pressure. We don't want to embarrass the family. It's not really important that we, you know, have to put out this information about maybe an embarrassing death. And so they will put something down that isn't exactly what really happened. Is that what you're finding?
Yeah, I mean, this is all up to the discretion of the justices of the peace. And don't get me wrong, there are a lot of justices of the peace out there that do things right. And when they have a question about how a death might have really happened and don't feel comfortable enough to make that cause and manner of death determination themselves, they will enlist the help of a medical examiner who might be at a private office or at a nearby county that has a medical examiner, and they can contract with them to conduct an autopsy so they can really understand what that is. That does happen a lot of the times, but, you know, like in the instance of the county that we're really honing in on in this investigation, Burnett County, in the last 5 years, the justices of the peace there have investigated more than 800 unattended deaths, and only about half of those were referred to a medical examiner for an autopsy to get that actual medical knowledge behind what happened in that death. So, you know, it does happen.
Why are you spotlighting Burnett?
Interesting you say that. We actually stumbled upon a blog post from a man that was in eighth grade back in 1965 and has never been able to really forget about the death of one of his classmates, a 13-year-old girl named Dana Lewis. He has this local blog that a lot of people in Burnett County follow, and he has highlighted this case several times just because there were so many questions about how she died. Her body was found hanging by a jump rope in the shed behind her family's home. It was 59 years ago this week that it happened. And this justice of the peace that investigated the death ruled it an accident, which always seemed a little strange to people that knew this girl. And they never quite believed that that's what happened, that something else might have been behind the cause of her death. So that's really what kind of got us looking into it. And, you know, we were able to kind of just go through history with Burnett County and then looking at the rest of Texas, because this system has existed for 200 years in Texas, and it's pretty much the same as it was back then when you talk about the death inquest part of the job of being a justice of the peace.
So it seemed like your investigation is kind of following two tracks. You have the storytelling that you're doing with the hanging on Backbone Creek about the young girl. And then also you're doing kind of a wonky investigation into the JP not being able to really be equipped really to do the job that we need for solving crimes. Is that it?
That's exactly right. We're using this case to highlight what there are possible problems with the larger system and why it's unique in Texas, why it's existed for so long here, and the efforts that could be coming out of the Capitol to help modernize the system.
One of the criticisms is that, or obviously pointing out a problem, is that it's expensive to do a autopsy or a complete investigation, a CSI-type investigation for every unnatural death that occurs. So you kind of just call out the JP, and he does a saddleback view of what's going on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, for counties that don't have a medical examiner, it can be, first, very expensive and costly to taxpayers to establish a medical examiner office. So that's why many counties haven't done that quite yet, because their population hasn't hit the required legal threshold in Texas, which is currently 2.5 million, and most counties don't have that many people. The other part of the cost is if you do decide to contract with a medical examiner, if your county doesn't have one already, we found that it can cost up to $4,700 per body. So justices of the peace are also trying to be budget-minded, and they have to realize that that does add up a lot if you put every single body, and transport them to another county for that autopsy.
So big picture, having this system in place for the majority of counties in Texas where the JP does this work, are we, one, sometimes on occasion allowing murders to be classified as accidental deaths or something else, and an injustice happens? And two, are we missing the big picture when it comes to crimes, problems like overdose deaths or other deaths that we have in the state that we need good data for, and we're just not getting it?
Well, I think that's what critics will tell you, that certainly is happening. And there has been, great reporting that's happened over the years about those type of instances. The trouble is that it's so hard to track in Texas because there's no uniform system that is readily accessible to the public to figure out what's happening with these deaths, to maybe see if there's any anomalies or any trends with specific counties. You have to go county to county, precinct to precinct, and request those records from those justices of the peace individually, and that can really be a time-consuming process, very costly also, and then many of these counties and precincts don't really have that many open records requests, so you're kind of having to teach them what to do along the way.
Right, and they also maybe have their own sort of freelance style of keeping records that, is not always, up to code. Josh Hinkle
exactly.
is the Director of Investigations and Innovation at KXAN NBC Austin. They have a long track record of breaking stories and winning awards. Josh, it's great to have you on here.
Thank you so much.
When we come back from the break, the holidays are here. It's going to be a great fest for many of us. But what about people who don't have the abundance that we all have? What can we do to help them? The Food Bank, next on The Source. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. And a little later, we're going to be having a conversation with District 9 Councilmember John Courage. He's a leading candidate for mayor. This weekend, he has a gun buyback program. We can talk to him about a lot of issues that are happening in San Antonio. But right now, the holidays are right on top of us. And for the San Antonio Food Bank, they are working double time to help fight hunger and feed hope in our community. And we're joined by Eric Cooper, who is the CEO of the San Antonio Food Bank. And Eric, welcome back to The Source.
Oh, thank you so much, David. Privileged to be on.
Well, first of all, I want to mention the fact that this is a weekend where folks can donate a turkey to help the food bank. Can you tell me the details about that?
You bet. So all month long, we've been working to try to collect support through the donation of non-perishable canned goods that complement Thanksgiving, all types of items being donated. But we're really now focusing on the center of the plate, the frozen turkey, and we've been collecting turkeys throughout the month. This weekend, there's several locations throughout the city that individuals and families that would like to donate a turkey to another family can do that. You just have to go to our website and see where we're at. The logistics become a part of the challenge when it comes to taking a frozen turkey from one place to another. But we do this every year, and we are able to raise thousands of turkeys, and we just hope that we'll have enough to meet this year's demand.
So it seems the simplest way, I think on Saturday, between certain hours, what is it like from 12 to 2 or something like that, if you go to HEB's and you can buy a turkey and hand it off to somebody, or how would that work?
Yeah, exactly right. Again, listeners, you're going to want to go to our website to know which of the HEBs are accepting frozen turkeys. When you go to HEB to do your grocery shopping, you can purchase a frozen turkey there. And then as you're exiting the store, you'll see the San Antonio Food Bank refrigerated trucks and lots of volunteers, and they'll take the turkey donation there and get it under cold storage on site, and then those turkeys will come to the food bank and go out to families. Now, if you can't make it out to donate a frozen turkey in person, you can always donate online and through the website. You can make a monetary donation that will go to purchase a turkey. A great tradition that we have is our annual turkey trot, which is on Thanksgiving morning. It's a 5K run walk. Registration fees for the turkey trot go to help purchase turkeys. And then if you're listening or you know someone that is in need of a turkey, please reach out to us at the San Antonio Food Bank. You can call our helpline at 210-431-8326. Again, 210-431-8326 to be directed to where physical turkeys are being distributed. And if you're in a rural community, you're piloting for the first time a virtual turkey. And what that is, David, is if someone is calling, we have now a technology that we're using that allows us to text message a virtual gift card that would be redeemed at the closest retailer where that recipient of that turkey is located. And so we just want to make sure that families have access to that center of the plate. The Thanksgiving is not necessarily Thanksgiving without the turkey. And so we want to make sure that we're able to provide that for those struggling families that might need it.
Right. We've seen inflation take a bite out of a lot of families' budgets. Hunger isn't just a Thanksgiving problem. I always feel kind of like a jerk just talking to you on Thanksgiving. I want to talk to you all year long, Eric, to remind people of the needs that we have here locally. But, you know, the food bank is something that is doesn't just operate during holidays.
Yeah, you nailed it, David. Hunger doesn't know a holiday. It's a 365 issue for many families. And, you know, but it is this meal of the year that is probably the most celebrated. It's a meal of plenty and bounty. And for so many families, they have that expectation on them. At a turkey distribution last week, many parents came up to me just to express gratitude that now they would be able to meet the expectation of Thanksgiving because they had a turkey. And I think sometimes we don't fully appreciate that for moms that want to provide for their children, like all moms, struggle with basic nourishment. But now the hype around the day, she's almost set up to fail. And they definitely want families that donate to know how grateful they are that that they will be the hero to their family because they've provided, and that expectation will be met.
Do you have a need for extra hands, helping hands, to hand out turkeys and fill boxes and stuff these days?
We We sure do. And thank you so much for mentioning that, because the food bank always needs food, and you can donate, as we mentioned, you know, financially you can contribute, but the biggest need is right now for volunteers. And whether in our warehouse packing the boxes that will go out, or in our kitchens making the meals, we'll do thousands and thousands of prepared Thanksgiving meals, and these will come through our kitchens on Thanksgiving Day. We'll be serving the homeless throughout Bexar County, and so please, if you have a little bit of extra time and can come and donate a little bit of time to us, our farm and garden is up in full swing, so if you'd like that type of experience, it's kid-friendly. You can come as an individual or a family, or bring your company or club. But boy, you'll get a lot done in a short amount of time in the fight against hunger. You just need to go to our website and register. You'll see all the different volunteer activities on our website that you can do, and just pick out a convenient time that works for you and your friends.
So right now we're going into a new presidential administration. The Republican Party has a trifecta in Washington, D.C. One of the things that they're talking about are cuts to the food stamp program, particularly to help pay for more tax cuts to the upper brackets in our tax system. Are you following what could be happening with the cuts to food stamps? What can the average guy do in order to express the fact that this is not something that they voted for?
Yeah, I tell you, hunger is a policy choice. And I think that we could be better when it comes to the policies that help those that are most vulnerable. And the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, it really is the nation's safety net around nourishment. It helps put food on the table along with our neighbors' own earned income. So, you know, for seniors, it might be their Social Security, but for working families on SNAP, they are contributing their income, which is inadequate to pay their household bills, and SNAP is a supplement to that. If SNAP were to be cut, there is no way that the San Antonio Food Bank would be able to meet that demand. And so we're watching it incredibly close and working hard to educate those that are newly taking office, or those that have been around a while, just to remind them that, you know, food, it's what nourishes us. And when you look at chronic diseases, when you look at the stress of our country, mental health, a lot of it, food, you know, intertwines in the mix. And so we want to make sure that we've got a strong homeland security strategy, the military. Many people don't realize that the school lunch program was started because soldiers were enlisting malnourished. They weren't healthy. And we knew then that we needed a strategy to make sure kids got access to good nutrition. Well, that nutrition shouldn't stop at graduation. And, you know, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program helps for those low wage earners that don't make enough to be able to provide food for themselves and their children.
It seems like, I'm still recovering from processing what happened with this election. And I'm feeling like to deal with that, we have to make individual choices to be a moral person who's going to work to do good wherever I can in my little world. And ways to do that would be to interact and find ways to make the world better. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with larger policies in our government, but at least in my little world, I can do some things like donate a turkey, or go online and make a virtual donation, or go to the food bank and fill boxes, or, you know, hoe weeds or whatever you can do. So, I mean, I think that now is the time for a call to action for people who want to be do good, to do good.
Yeah, I think, you know, the election, there were winners and losers. And I think if the party that you voted for didn't take office and you feel that anxiety and that stress and fear, I think the best way to mend what's broken in all of us, I think, is service. And it's selfless. It takes our minds off of our own challenges and puts it on the challenges of others. In some ways, that's a little naive when you look at what's at stake, but it is something that can be done. And I think we're going to need more of it. I think our nation absolutely needs to come together and address critical issues. And food has the power to bring people together. It has the power to bring people to the common table. And you know, I would hope that our future will be one of just really committing that we have to work together, that the polarization of our nation, that African parable, when the elephants fight, the grass dies, is the reality when it comes to those that struggle. They need good policy, and we should make it impactful and effective and efficient. And I think sometimes the red tape or the just the process becomes such a barrier that families in Texas don't get access because of the application being too long or too difficult. Or, to be honest, David, the state doesn't even draw down the benefit that becomes accessible, specifically the summer EBT program. You know, these are resources that families desperately need and could really nourish their families, but we don't participate.
So you have the turkey drive this weekend. Go online to the food bank, and you can see which HEBs at what time you can go and buy a turkey, and they'll get it to a family and keep it cold and healthy. So, like, how are you set for turkeys? Every year it's kind of seems like, will there be enough? Will the food bank have enough?
Well, we're taking requests throughout our 39 counties, through our programs and our 800 partner pantries. And so we've tallied up the demand on the pantries, and looks like we're trying to get to about 30,000 turkeys. We've got about 20,000 identified. But if your company is maybe giving away turkeys and you've got a couple of vegan employees or young employees that are going to eat with their parents and don't need them and want to donate that, there's a lot of companies that have been calling us with surplus turkeys. And when we can get those from those that have them, we can surely get those to families in need throughout South Texas. Now, we'll be doing this all the way up to the day before Thanksgiving, and then any turkey that comes in thereafter will be a Christmas turkey for sure.
Eric Cooper is the CEO for the San Antonio Food Bank. Eric, thanks for talking to us today.
David, thank you, and have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. When we come back from the break, we're joined by John Courage, San Antonio District 9 Council member, candidate for San Antonio Mayor. We'll be right back. The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. If you have any old firearms lying around your house, you don't want them to fall into the wrong hands, and you want to find a safe and reliable way to make sure that they are destroyed, then District 9 San Antonio City Councilmember John Courage has a deal for you. Councilmember Courage is in the studio right now, and he's here to take your questions and calls. Number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Councilman Courage, welcome to The Source.
Great to Thank you, David. It's good to be here.
So you got the gun buyback program. You did it last year. Overwhelming success, turnout, people showing up. I was there. So what's happening this year?
Well, let me just correct it. It's not a gun buyback. It is a weapons exchange. People who don't have have weapons and they no longer think they need them in their family home, this is an opportunity to exchange those, as you mentioned, for HEB gift cards. And we hope that many people who weren't able to do it last time, and there were many who showed up when we ran out of cards, are ready to do it this time. The whole idea is just to make homes safer in our community.
So when I was there last year, a line of cars, just like in truckloads of weapons that were collected, and people were happy in order to be able to get gift cards for HEB, and they were able to turn that into, you know, holiday meals and
That's
things.
Right.
Were you surprised at the turnout?
Yeah, we were. We were really thinking we might be able to bring in maybe 500 weapons, which we would have considered a success. But we actually had over 900 turned in, and people literally were turned away because we ran out of the cards. There were a few that said, "We'll even go ahead and donate the guns. We've been sitting here, so you know." And we were able to take a few, but the police had already started putting things away. And so we encourage people, go to your local police department, call them, one of the substations, and they'll take the weapons for you. So it was just a tremendous success, we believe. And our goal this time is to go ahead and try and have people bring in 1,000 weapons, and hopefully we'll be successful and even greater than that.
When I spoke to people who were participating, it seemed like they were really, really interested in making sure that the weapons are destroyed. Mm-hmm. A lot of people had guns that they had inherited, they didn't know what to do with, or these were weapons that they no longer used. And so they just wanted to make sure that gun was never used to hurt anyone or used to commit a crime. So they really wanted it destroyed. How do Yes. we know that those guns were actually smashed into bits?
Well, that's a good question. We're going to post through my office and try and get it out to the media to show when those guns were actually destroyed. I was there. Several of my staff members were there. And we watched them go up the conveyor belt to go into a machine that just broke them all up into pieces at one of the metal recycling plants in Seguin. So we saw them get destroyed. We know they were. We've got some pictures about it, too.
Well, there were some people who aren't that happy about having guns destroyed. They are Second Amendment supporters, and they just think that having guns destroyed is a bad deal. And then they were really upset. I posted my story online. It was picked up, and I thousands and thousands of people, cursed at me for doing a story like this. You know, it's like, I'd take those guns. I'll take that gun. Why are you destroying that gun? You know, it was pretty. I've never had that kind of reaction for a story before.
Well, you know, it kind of reminds me that the city twice a year sends around trucks to pick up things that people don't want in their homes anymore. No one complains about that. So why would you complain if somebody has another item they no longer want, they no longer need, and they want to voluntarily get out of their home? So what if it's a gun? You know, the process is the same. If people don't want something, they don't need something, they don't feel it's a part of their life anymore, or they don't feel like it's safe to keep in their home for their family, then why not go through this process of just turning it over and getting a little something for it?
Right.
To make sure, the real issue is to make sure these weapons are never used again to harm somebody, to threaten somebody, for somebody to harm themselves, or to be used in a crime. There's nothing wrong with that, and it is a totally voluntary exchange.
And some of the weapons that were turned in and they still got gift cards were non-functioning weapons. So that's something that people, you know, you may have something that doesn't really work or you don't know if it works. It's still valuable to be turned in.
Well, you know, this was the first time, last year was the first time we did this. We didn't want to be exclusive to where there wouldn't be weapons turned in that could be repaired to be used if people didn't want them. But we ended up getting a few, not many, that were inoperative, that probably wouldn't be able to be repaired or anything. We're being a little more careful this time. We're working closer with the SAPD. They are going to have people from their firing range there looking at the guns that come in and determining if they are weapons that could be used and if they're, for example, a pellet gun or a BB gun or a gun that's obviously broken and inoperable. We're not going to go ahead and give the gift cards for those. We've tried to make that public and let people know about that. But there'll probably be a few that turn up, and more than likely people say, well, I don't need it anyway, and we'll just dump it in the trash with the other guns. But the point is that we want to go ahead and allow people to make their homes safer and make sure those weapons don't get into a situation where someone's hurt, harmed, threatened, or a crime's committed.
And last year there was a hiccup, a problem, when there was an SAPD officer who didn't want – he saw a couple of guns that he thought, these are pretty cool. I like to have these guns. Unfortunately, he made a bad call. He paid the price for it. But the positive upside of that is acknowledging that there is oversight and that there is an accounting being done for every weapon that is being turned in. And if you do turn in a weapon, it doesn't end up in the collection of somebody who shouldn't have it.
That's exactly right. And it is unfortunate that that officer made that choice. But we were being observant. All of my staff are going to be staffing every location where a weapon will be exchanged and a card will be handed out. We also work much more closely with SAPD to make sure that every officer who's going to be involved in this has a complete understanding of what their job is going to be, what their obligation is. And so I think it's going to be even more successful. And I think that people will feel good about knowing that these weapons will eventually be destroyed. And so that's the whole process behind this now.
Now, the HEB gift cards, where are these? Is that donated by HEB?
They sell us the gift cards at about a 5% discount. So that's their contribution. And if you're talking about $150,000 worth of gift cards or more, it'll be more this year, you know, then that's, you know, $6,000-$7,000.
And so the rest of it, is that from coming from your discretionary budget or from volunteer donations?
From all of those. Yeah, I'm using money from discretionary funds that I'm carrying forward from either other projects that didn't work out for whatever reason or even former staff members who left and we had a little residual revenue that wasn't paid out for those things. And also, though, we have gotten contributions from several religious organizations, which I'm very pleased to see, and from people in the community who just believe that this is a worthwhile effort. So it's a combination of resources.
This week, the San Antonio City Council will be getting a briefing. I think this is going to be the first public briefing that's going to be given for what we know as Project Marvel, which could be a building, a new Spurs home downtown where part of Old Hemisphere, where the Institute of Texan Cultures, UTSA land is now. What are you looking for?
Well, you know, I got a briefing about that today on my desk that kind of has some proposed features of what could be there going forward. Nothing is done to a point where there's any kind of drawings or plans or deals that have been cut. It's all been, well, we want to go ahead and improve the convention center, because we're missing out on businesses to other cities in Texas that have larger facilities. We want to go ahead and add another hotel downtown. We've got a good site for it. We want to continue to improve the Alamo Dome, which is 30 years old, so it maintains its efficiency and its usefulness in the community and in the sports world. And the Spurs have said they want to go ahead and move downtown. And so they've got a lot to work out through with the county before they're going to be in a position to do that. But I think they recognize that the location of the ITC which UTSA has said they no longer want to maintain, would be a very good location for adding a sports arena for a new Spurs move in the future. So, you know, the pieces look possible, but nothing has been committed. And we're hopeful today that we'll be able to kind of look at those pieces of land and possible land and some concepts on what could go there and how we can improve existing city facilities. And that's part of what we'll be looking at today.
All right, so we're going to take a break here. We'll come back. We'll follow up talking about Project Marvel, a possible new downtown home for the San Antonio Spurs. If you have a question or a comment for City Council member from District 9, John Courage, he's also running for mayor, by the way. We should get into that. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And we're going to be back in 1 minute. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the TPR studios, John Courage. He is the San Antonio District 9 Council member, and he is a candidate running for San Antonio mayor. That election will be in May. If you've got a question or a comment, we're talking about Project Marvel. We're talking about the gun buyback. We're also, if you have any other questions about the other issues, the reproductive justice fund, law and order in San Antonio, those city charter issues that we voted on, give us a call. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to a caller, Samir. Samir, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for having me. I just wanted to call in and thank Mr. Courage. My wife and I have lived in District 9 since 2007. And after the 2016 election, when he decided to run for council, my wife and I remember meeting you, sir, at, I believe, your house. And we block walked over 100 homes for you that year. And we were pretty, very proud to be able to flip the district for the first time. And just wanted to say thank you for being our councilman and bringing the senior center and the dog park in Stone Oak and the many other things that you did. We want to wish you well in your mayoral run. But my question is on the SISD issue right now and then trying to sell the land. I just wanted to hear your thoughts about it. And my concern is I just want to make sure the taxpayers get their money's worth out of that deal. And
yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Samir. So thank you for that call, Samir. So this has to do with the Missions ballpark that's also being planned for development.
Right. You know, I think that the developers are facing a dilemma with the San Antonio Independent School District. But, of course, the school district is, you know, facing its own dilemma economically, financially, because of lack of state support. But I don't know how that is going to be remedied. I think that the school district is asking for a lot and a lot more than I think the developers were initially considering to bring this project together. And quite honestly, if that deal falls through for that land, that whole deal falls through, including the people that may have to move out of the Soapworks apartments. So there's still a little bit that remains to be resolved, and that piece of land is a very important part of it. So I don't know how it'll turn out, but, you know, I think in general people would appreciate having a nice new ball field downtown. I think it would be beneficial to downtown, the northwest part of the downtown community. But I've always said I would not commit $1 of your tax dollars to pay for that. Now, when the developers have put this plan together, they are going to be developing property for housing and for retail and other commercial ventures, and they're going to pay for that. And the growth of that in city tax dollars in the future will pay for that new stadium. And so that's growth that they're going to be providing that will pay for the growth for the stadium. And I think that's the right way we should go, even with the Spurs in the future.
So SISD is playing hardball when it comes to, you want our land, well, you're going to pay for it. And they're saying, okay, you need to develop affordable housing in our district where we have a need for that. And they're saying, we also want you to pay $400,000 a year, which is something that they said is a number they came up with through, you know, equitable formula. They also want them to build them this other education facility. So we're talking about people who have a lot of money. You know, these are high rollers, and they want this land. And I don't think SAISD should be giving it to them on the cheap. They should really make them pay for it, right?
Well, I think that's going to be up to the developers and the school district to come to what they think is a fair price for it.
All right, well, let's go to another caller. We have Elizabeth. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Hi, Elizabeth.
Yes. Hi there. Hi, Council Member
Hello.
Courage. I just wanted to say that I have some questions related to our community bond projects. The city, I really believe that actually Public Works does a lot to try to get, you know, our environmental concerns taken care of and our drainage concerns. The San Antonio River Authority also does a lot of work. And very often it seems like the public isn't aware of how all these things tie in.
Yes.
And I feel like that might be partially an issue with our council and their level of being informed on how, you know, how to help the public with this. Is there anything you could do to kind of make that a little bit better for the public as far as understanding our projects and understanding that they really are, there is a master plan, so to speak?
You know, that's a fair observation.
Yeah. Just thanking Elizabeth for your call.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that a lot of growth and development in the city of San Antonio, particularly across districts 8 and 9 and even district 10, involve development over the aquifer and different parts of the aquifer, the recharge zone, the contributing zone, etc. And a lot of that development has to be monitored and approved ahead of time by TCEQ, which is the state agency that oversees those kinds of environmental issues. And a lot of that leads to delays in the execution of a lot of development in those areas. Now, in many parts of the city, you're not in the Edwards Aquifer recharge area, and so there aren't the same kind of regulations or delays in doing development. And I think that also when you look at a lot of things like zoning, for example, you know, SAWS, which maintains our water resources, also has some regulation over how much land gets developed and how much land may not be developed. Again, it's to allow the natural flow of waters in the area. So sometimes they affect the zoning that goes into the final development of a project. And people just don't understand those little issues. And sometimes some council members don't understand it. What I've learned in 7.5 years is the city of San Antonio and everything we do is just so much more complex than the average person might think. You would think if we're going to develop a park, it takes 6 months. And what you find out is it takes 5 years. And I've found that out being on the council, you know, for 7.5 years now.
I'm going to swivel back over to Project Marvel. So you've got a briefing, a report to go over.
Right.
It's nothing slick. It's a lot of numbers and, you know, possibilities and what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So is UTSA, are they looking for a land swap with the city of San Antonio? Are they looking for cash? What's on the table?
You know, I think it's really part of or either or of those can make that deal work. Obviously, they're growing a lot downtown, and the city has
they're doing
has
great things sold, for downtown.
Yeah, we've sold property to them, and they're developing very effectively. They're going if they close the ITC, they want to develop another center to promote the cultures of Texas near the Alamo. So there may be avenues for swap, or it could be an outright purchase. Nothing has been defined. It's all conceptual. How about this? How about that? One reason is we know, for example, if the Spurs want to go there, they've got a contract with the county to stay out at the the Frost Center for, I think, another 6-7 years. So not everything is going
into
to move as quickly. Yeah.
So, but, you know, they've broken contracts or negotiated away out of contracts before. They did that to go to the East Side. So, you know, that's just part of doing business for these guys. But one thing, I've talked to an expert on building stadiums and stuff, and how they said that San Antonio is in a very unique position. They thought it was really kind of odd that we're talking about the two big developments simultaneously downtown. And so we have what's being promised for Project Marvel, what's being promoted for the new Mission stadiums. And they're saying that probably having two things developed together simultaneously will kind of eat into, there's only going to be one Topgolf facility. There's only going to be one. You have to pick between one and the other. You can't. And so they may be saying, okay, this project looks great. Here's what it looks like. This is what it's going to do for land values. But actually, by doing both simultaneously, it could cut into what those promises look like. Is that being considered?
I'm sure it's being considered in the minds of our staff members who are working in the finance department and the city manager's department. But as council members, we rely on their professionalism to come to us and tell us, this is how we think it's going to work. This is how we can make it work. These are the possibilities. And we really haven't had those conversations yet, because other than with the baseball field, there is nothing in writing, solid in expectations. It's all conceptual, what we'd like to see, what we could see. Other than the fact that we do know we have to expand the convention center, we do need to improve the Alamo Dome, and that we want to go ahead and add more hotel space and other commercial development. A lot of it is also assisted by the state because of state law passed a couple of years ago that will enable us to use growth in state hotel taxes to come to the city to pay for this development. And so as the city's hotel tax grows above a certain level, once we start this project, we will be the beneficiary of that in the city. Instead of going to the state, we can use that to pay part of the costs.
So there's no vote scheduled for anything with Project Marvel. This is just a public briefing for you guys, trying to bring some transparency to a project that's kind of been doing in, you know, in private meetings. But are you excited? Are you interested? Just want to learn more?
Well, you know, I want the Spurs to stay in San Antonio. And if building an arena downtown that they pay for is going to help keep them here, I'll build the streets around it and put up the lights.
All right. Councilmember John Courage, District 9. He is a candidate for mayor. We have an election in May. It could be a crowded ballot, but you're polling at the top for being recognized. And so good luck to you on that. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.